Chapter 79.
I hear you need a boffin.
Beth's head jerked up. Harry stood leaning against the library door, old jacket thrown over one shoulder. His black hair was shorter. He would no longer be forgetting the barber for weeks at a time because of triple shift bingers breaking U-boat codes. She'd forgot how big he was. "You're here," she said, heart thudding. His gaze went over her and she winced at the horror that flashed briefly across his eyes. She was clean scrubbed now. A long soak in Mrs. Knox's bathtub had washed away the asylum smell. But there wasn't any hiding her skeletal thinness, her ragged hair and nails. "Harry," she said, hearing the rasp in her own voice now, the perpetual hoarseness from years of daily vomiting.
"Mrs. Knox let me in."
He looked like he had a river of words begging to be released, but he kept his voice careful, quiet, like a man trying not to spook a wild animal.
"Mab and Osler, are they—"
"Mab's making coffee. Osler was called to London." Harry had a fellowship at his old college in Cambridge now. Mab had tracked him down yesterday. Beth felt her hand stealing up to worry at her hair and made it stop.
"My college owed me some days."
Harry took a step forward.
"Beth, how is Sheila?"
Beth blurted out. She wanted to know why he'd never come to Clockwell. She also didn't know if she could bear to hear the answer. "And Christopher?" Harry pulled himself visibly back from some ledge.
"He's well. My father's come round a bit about us never darkening his doorstep. He sent Christopher to a specialist to have his ankle operated on. He walks quite a bit better now. Sheila's over the moon."
"That's good." Beth took a deep breath. "Did Mab tell you about Giles?"
"Yes."
Harry said something flat and filthy about Giles Talbot.
"This cipher message you broke. How is it the Soviets were talking about Giles in English via an Enigma machine when they don't use Enigma for their own traffic?"
Beth had thought about that.
"Probably a captured German army machine. Maybe they were communicating with his handler in England, asking more about its uses and operation. Who knows?"
Harry pulled up a chair.
"How can I help?"
She pushed the rose messages across the desk. He leafed through the sheets of Enigma traffic, a smile touching the corner of his mouth, and Beth's heart plucked.
"This takes me back."
He inhaled the smell of the decrypt paper.
"I'm working theoretical mathematics now, the Poincaré conjecture, stuff I missed when I was at BP. Pure research, no lives at stake. But sometimes I look round my office and I miss the night shifts, the chicory coffee, the morning rush on the U-boat traffic.
Working elbow to elbow in Knox's section, everybody climbing over each other when the dispatch riders came in." Beth could have had another year of that if she'd worked to the end of the war. Yet another thing Giles had taken from her. She shook the anger off. There was no time for it.
"We don't have much in the way of cribs."
She walked Harry through how she'd broken the first rose message. He fell into the work without another word. She fell into it too, with another steadying inhale.
"I looked for you as soon as I was demobbed."
He spoke perhaps an hour later, quiet words dropping into the stillness.
"Your mother told me you'd died in an institution. She wouldn't even tell me where you were buried."
Beth squeezed her eyes shut. "Ah, mother."
"You never talked about her. I didn't know enough to disbelieve her."
A ragged pause.
"I loved you, and I left you in that place."
"Harry." Beth broke in desperately. "Let's stay focused, shall we? I can't—" She trailed off. He blew out an uneven breath.
"All right."
Beth looked at the cipher message before her, not seeing it for a moment. "I loved you. Past tense." Well, 3.5 years was a long time. She went back into the spirals of Rose with something of an effort. Another hour limped by, working a potential crib that went nowhere. Beth sat back, eyes burning. "Why can't I do this?" she heard herself whisper. "I've been going at it 3 days now, and there's nothing. I can't see it the way I used to."
"You will."
"What if I don't?" The words came out more despairing than she'd intended. "What if I can't do it anymore?"
The thing that terrified her most, being locked out. That headlong rush of falling down the spiral into Wonderland, the world of letters and patterns that she'd walked in with such starry-eyed enchantment. Now she was banging on Wonderland's gates until her fists bled, and everything remained locked. How much of my mind did I leave inside those walls? In the asylum, she'd felt like the sanest one there. Now she was out, and she felt like a caged lunatic on display at a circus. Harry's big hand extended across the desk. Beth hesitated, then slid her bitten raw fingertips into his palm.
Beth, you didn't leave any part of your mind in that place.
His gaze was steady.
You can still do this.
Her eyes blurred. He was warm, he was sane, and he believed in her.
Just don't treat me like I'm made of glass, Harry. I don't have time to be broken right now.
Later, when Giles was caught, she'd let herself shiver and sob, feel all the damage the asylum had inflicted on her. Not now. He squeezed her hand fiercely.
Then let's get back to work.
Another hour later, Harry was reading through Boxing Chains as Beth tried to follow a Dilly-esque thought about crabs and turnovers, and they both looked up as heels clattered in the corridor.
We're absolutely dished, Osler called, stamping into the library in her Buckingham Palace finery. I've had no luck. Harry!
Hello, gorgeous.
Harry rose, picking Osler up and out of her tiny patent leather slingbacks.
I thought you'd be a duchess by now.
Even worse, darling. I'm engaged to a traitor, hadn't you heard?
Osler turned to Beth as Harry set her back into her shoes, and Mab came into the room drying her hands on a tea towel.
I tapped all my godfather's people in London, discreetly. No luck figuring out where we might turn up an Enigma machine.
Forget the Enigma machine for now. We still need a good break before we've got anything to feed into one.
Beth tugged at her frayed hair.
And we're not getting there fast enough.
We need more brains on this, Harry considered, fingers drumming. I'll ring the prof. He's in Cambridge on a sabbatical year. And my cousin Maurice. He worked on ciphers in Block F, and he's at the Crédit Lyonnais in London now. If they could come and put a few days in.
We can't tell anyone about this, Beth protested, panic beginning to lick through her veins. We can't trust.
We can.
Harry's voice was quiet but very sure.
Beth, not many people have friends with intelligence work clearance and the absolute ability to keep secrets, but we do. Christ, do we ever. And we have a traitor loose and only a matter of days to catch him. Let's put out the call to the ones we can trust.
We trusted Giles, Osler pointed out.
We have to trust that he's the only bad apple in our acquaintance. We were picked. We were vetted. Overall, we have to trust that the process worked, or else BP would never have thrived.
A long pause.
What do we tell them?
Beth said, gnawing her thumbnail.
That is BP business, Mab said. They'll drop everything and come running, just like us. They spent an entire war doing that. It's in their blood.
I'll make up some more beds, said Mrs. Knox, behind Mab. Though I'll wager there won't be much sleeping. Goodness, how exciting.
Off she went, waving off help, and the others looked at one another.
Assemble the Mad Hatters.
Osler headed for the telephone.
Invitations are being issued for one last absolutely topping tea party.
Chapter 80. Knock, knock.
Mr. Turing.
Mab greeted the dark-haired, round-shouldered man she'd seen ramble through BP, followed by admiring whispers.
Thank you for coming at such short notice. Take this.
Folding his hand instantly around a cup of coffee. She'd learned something these last few days about dealing with cryptanalysts. Point them at the coffee, point them at the problem, then get out of the way.
Works over there, in Dilly's library.
The prof ambled to a seat opposite Beth and Harry, and Beth pushed over a stack of increasingly dog-eared messages.
Let's see.
He began humming tunelessly, and Mab had to stop herself from snapping.
Stop that!
She wasn't going to snap at Alan Bloody Turing just because she was missing her family and felt like biting someone's head off. Mab had rung home that morning to say she'd be away another few days. The conversation with Mike had contained a lot of thorny silences and questions she'd had no choice but to evade.
Think about that later, she advised herself.
Knock, knock.
One of Dilly's team,
Mab guessed, assessing the rosy-cheeked woman in the corridor. "For Lydia Kent, look, I'm happy to help, but I need some sort of authorization or proof that what you're doing here is on the up." "We're working on that. Come in, have a go." Knock, knock. A brisk blonde broom handle of a woman in a home-knit jumper came straight in and kissed Mrs. Knox on the cheek. Mab didn't know her except that she'd been another of Dilly's team. "I thought she was the traitor," Beth had said. "Thank God she's not, because she's as good a codebreaker as me." "Peggy Rock, came as soon as I could. What have you got? And why do I need to get us authorization to investigate it?"
"We're calling it Rose."
Harry pulled out a chair for her at what Mab was already thinking of as Boffin Island, the desk and two tables all pushed together, covered in decrypts, pencils and rods. Like Puffin Island off the coast of Wales, where Mike had taken Mab on their honeymoon, but covered in weird cryptanalysts instead of weird birds. "Hello, you," Peggy greeted Beth. "I thought you'd had a breakdown." "Frame up," Beth said succinctly. "Bastard." Peggy surveyed everything, hearing the rest of Harry's succinct explanation. "All right, let me work up some official cover for all this through my office. Semi-sanctioned operation investigating remaindered code for purposes of research and security, maybe." That, Mab thought, ought to satisfy any of the BP volunteers who wanted something more concrete than Beth's word that they were working for legitimate purposes. "I'll talk to my superior at GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters," Peggy expanded when Beth looked blank. "Where I work now. The name's changed from the GC and CS days, but it's the same stuff. Code-breaking when we're not at war."
"Is there any chance you could get your hands on an Enigma machine through your office?" Mab broke in. "Surely they can't all have been destroyed after the war."
Peggy reversed for the telephone.
"Let me ring a chap."
It really was the most extraordinary thing, Mab thought. BP men and women came and went from Corns Wood. Some of them Mad Hatters she had known like family, some vague acquaintances from night shifts or the canteen. Every one vouched for. Peggy got them some mysterious authorizations, worked 48 hours round the clock, then departed looking elusive. The prof came and went with an absent expression, 2 hours here, 4 hours there, whenever he could make the journey from Cambridge. A bespectacled fellow of Worcester College dropped in from Oxford and had a pencil in hand before, "Arthur, absolutely ripping. Does everyone know Arthur from Hut 6? Was fully out of Osler's mouth. Harry's cousin Maurice came, a cadaverous-looking man in the most expensive suit Mab had ever seen. Then a fellow named Cohen with a Glasgow accent. No one said Giles's name. No one discussed his treachery. No one had to be warned to say nothing when they departed.
"I've missed this,"
Phyllida sighed when she finally had to leave.
"Yes," Mab thought, "I've missed it too."
Though the work still had its stresses.
"Beth," Mab said, noticing her former billet mate had snapped two pencils in the last half hour. "Take 5 minutes. I'm going to trim your hair."
"Why?" Beth blinked.
"Because you need a spot of tending if you're going to get your focus back."
Cryptanalysts, Mab had learned, needed a certain amount of care if they were to perform at their peak. Thinking of Mrs. Knox and her wry indulgence of Dilly's quirks, and the way she kept supplying her sudden influx of visitors with coffee, Mab shooed Beth into the washroom, borrowed a pair of scissors, and began smartening up that butchered blonde hair while Beth slowly blinked her way back into the world around her.
"Why are you bothering?"
Beth asked, as Mab flicked a side part into place.
"You hate me, even if you did break me out of the asylum."
"I don't entirely hate you anymore, Beth." That surprised Mab, and she worked through it as she did her best to clip that Veronica Lake wave back into shape. After what Beth had endured at the asylum, it felt like only a heart of stone could condemn her to unrelenting hatred.
"When I look at you, I prickle, and I don't think I'll ever understand you. But no woman should walk around looking like she backed into a threshing machine."
And Beth went back to work, swinging her neatened hair in a pleased sort of way. And in another hour, she'd broken out a wheel setting on one of the messages.
"We're in luck."
Peggy Rock blew back into the library with a wooden case in her arms. Mab felt her neck tingle. She'd never laid eyes on an Enigma machine before, only the much bulkier Typex. This had the same rows of keys, the same set of wheels on one side, but it was sleeker, more compact, more dangerous.
"How?"
Harry's cousin Maurice breathed.
"Let's just say not all the machines were destroyed after the war," Peggy said with GCHQ caginess. "There's an underground bunker, never mind where.
My superior pulled strings to get me a machine on loan from the bunker. He's ex-BP, which helps.
Is there any chance that bunker has a bomb machine as well?
Harry asked as Peggy shut the wooden case into Dilly's wall safe.
It could cut days off the process.
You think I can magic up a bomb machine as easy as an Enigma? Something twice as big as a wardrobe?
Yes,
Beth, Osler, and Mab said in unison. Osler added, I'll eat my knickers if you haven't already asked. Peggy gave her close-lipped smile. A bomb. Mab hated the beasts, but she wasn't able to do much here at Cornswood, except refill the coffee. If they could get their hands on a machine... I may have made inquiries with my GCHQ superior. There may be a few surviving bombs in storage, and there may be one on loan to a computational research project based in London. Peggy dropped the hypothetical, seeing their impatient looks. It's in a repair lab at the moment, and there's no way to get it out, but we just might be able to get to it. The lab's closed up the last few days before the royal wedding. I could get us in, but we'd only have up until the wedding to work in privacy. Mab could see Beth hunching into herself at the thought of leaving Dilly's library, but she still nodded. It would help. One more thing, Peggy added. If it's in a repair lab, there's no guarantee what shape the machine will be in.
RAF engineers did bomb maintenance during the war,
the fellow named Cohen volunteered in his Glasgow burr.
I used to talk to them in the BP canteen. Let me see.
Disappearing toward the telephone.
We need more than a technician, Harry argued. We'll need someone to operate the ruddy thing.
Mab felt a grin hook itself nearly behind her ears. I can. Some muffled wrangling from the corridor, and eventually Cohen swung back in.
Alfred's in Inverness now, and David's on a jaunt to Penzance, but there's another laddie who can join us tomorrow night.
Have him meet us in London, said Peggy. By morning they were all piling into assorted cars and waving goodbye to Mrs. Knox. Beth and the Enigma machine hidden under a blanket in the back of Mab's Bentley. Their makeshift, miniature Bletchley Park was on the move. Knock, knock. Now the new arrivals had to come to a back door at the end of a complex of ugly warehouses clustered on the outskirts of London. The repair lab was echoingly empty, comprehensively locked. Someone anonymous came to the rear entrance and spoke briefly with Peggy. And then they were setting up shop all over again in a big maintenance bay, littered with tools and old tea mugs. Let me guess, Mab asked Peggy as Beth and the others began dragging tables together, unpacking the rose files. We dinna need to know what strings you pulled to make this happen. Peggy looked bland, unpacking the Enigma machine. We never leave the machines unattended, and no one comes in who isn't vouched for. Knock, knock. Came the rapping knuckles again, and Peggy let in Osler, staggering under a load of sandwiches, biscuits, and cigarettes. Sustenance, darlings! She laid out food, placed a sandwich actually in Beth's hand, because otherwise she wouldn't eat, and came to where Mab was working on their prize, the bomb on loan from its mysterious bunker, towering in one corner like a pagan altar. How's it coming? The drums are a mess. Mab shook out her fingers, sore and pinched from hours of teasing coiled wires apart with her eyebrow tweezers. Where's that bloody technician? Delayed, apparently. Let me see about getting some more hands to help with the wiring. In the meantime... Knock, knock. Val Glasbro, Mab said gratefully, as Peggy ushered in a familiar face a few hours later. Val Middleton now. You're lucky I was in town for the royal wedding. She brushed back a lot of glossy brown hair, sliding past Beth and the boffins hunched over their cipher messages. Peggy gave me the gist. Where do you want me? Grab a drum, darling, Osler called from where she sat with a drum in her own lap. The Bletchley Park bubble had snapped into place around the drafty maintenance bay, and there was a ticking clock hanging over their heads, as urgent as any they had slaved under at the park. Knock, knock. Long after sundown, Peggy ushered in the last arrival.
Sorry I'm late.
A man's voice floated from the corridor.
Had to find a mate to take the kids.
The Australian drawl penetrated Mab's ears belatedly. She was concentrating so hard on the drum before her. She frowned, straightening, just as a man's voice said,
Mab?
In the doorway, kit bag in hand, was her husband. Hut 6, Mab said. Then hut 11 and 11A. Then the mansion.
I worked East Coast, Wavendon, the outstations, Mike said. After I was shot down, they heard I was an engineer, slapped the Official Secrets Act in front of me, and set me to fixing bombs.
He shook his head.
And you were one of the operators. I thought they were all Wrens.
I was a fill-in because I was tall. Then I became a regular. The two of them were working alone by the bomb. Osler had taken Valerie, the tweezers, and a heap of drums to the other side of the room, tactfully giving Mab and her husband some privacy. Mab sat tweezing wires apart, and Mike was up to his elbows in the cabinet's back wiring, stripped down to shirt sleeves and braces. Mab could hardly look her husband in the eye. Mike had worked for Bletchley Park, her own husband.
How did we not run into each other?
He smiled, doing a delicate bit of work with narrow pliers.
I was called to BP now and then. It's how I got to know Cohen, one of those three-in-the-morning canteen friendships. If I'd seen you, I'd have noticed.
When did you come? 44. Thousands at BP by then. We didn't cross paths, that's all. It was perfectly possible, likely even.
So this is what had you flying south in such a hurry? Mike swiped his forehead on his elbow. A lot just straightened out in my mind.
I don't like the lying, Mab said, just to be clear. But I don't have a choice. He nodded.
It's what you do.
When you're us, she agreed.
Did he know?
Mike looked at her.
Francis?
Yes. She focused on the drum, prizing two crumpled wires apart. He wasn't BP, but he was in the same world.
Did that make it easier?
We didn't really have enough time to figure it out.
While we're telling truth.
Mike wore that guarded expression he had whenever the name Francis Gray came up.
When I look at you, I think how lucky I am. When you look at me, you think how I'm not him.
Mab looked down at the drum in her lap. Her husband's voice was steady.
Am I wrong?
Yes. She tweezed two wires apart. I don't think of him when I look at you, because I've tried to block him out altogether. It hurts less.
I think you blocked us both in the same go.
Francis, stocky and endlessly calm, holding her against him, rarely laughing. Mike, tall and exuberant, holding their babies, rarely without a grin. Maybe I did, Mab said, eyes filling until she could barely see the drum's wires.
I liked his poetry.
Mike reached for a spanner.
Read his book when I was in the RAF. Maybe we didn't have the same war, and he wasn't a flyer. But I could tell he got it. War.
Yes, he did. Her tears spilled over. Not a flood, just a trickle of pure pain for the man with the little girl in his arms, standing in the wreckage of Coventry, with both their lives stretching before them.
I don't mind hearing about him.
Mike's voice upturned at the end, the rest hanging unspoken.
I just want you to talk to me.
I'll tell you more about him someday. Mab wiped her eyes. Right now, I'd rather hear about you. What was the work like, fixing bombs? Her husband took the diversion, turned it over with his laconic Australian smile.
48 hours sometimes, trying to run down a fault. Some ran at your shoulder, going into spasms. How was your work?
Tedious, exciting, stressful, dull. A bit of everything. Mab managed a smile. Shall I tell you about the night all the Wrens and I stripped down and worked in our underwear?
Crikey, yes.
Hours later, Mab and her husband rose, looked around the maintenance bay, and realized everyone but Beth had left. It was midnight, the day before the royal wedding, and the bomb machine stood ready. Chapter 81. Tomorrow, Mab said, eyes gleaming. Or rather, later today, we'll be seeing what happens when we plug her up. She and her husband left arm in arm, grubby from machine oil. The last to go, Beth realized. One by one, the exhausted Mad Hatters had gone home to their unsuspecting families, crawled off to neglected flats for a few hours' sleep, or gone with Osler, who was putting the rest up in her Knightsbridge digs.
You're sleeping here?
Harry had asked Beth, pulling on his jacket. He'd been first to leave this evening, just after Mike Sharp had arrived. I made a nest of blankets in the supply closet. Peggy doesn't want the machines left alone.
Besides, Beth had no desire to head outside, even on London's outskirts, while Giles was in this city.
Are you going back to Cambridge?
I'll stay and see it through. Christopher knows his dad has important work right now.
Harry smiled.
Sheila sends her love.
Beth remembered something she hadn't thought of until now.
Did Sheila's flyer survive the war?
He did, actually. Nice chap. I've met him. Sheila spends every Tuesday and Thursday with him at his flat in Romford.
Harry had nodded goodnight and headed out, and now everyone had gone and Beth was alone in the echoing space, looking up at the impassive bronze face of the bomb.
You'd better be useful, she said aloud.
Feed me something useful first, it answered. She wandered back to Boffin Island and leafed through the stack of messages again.
Come on, Rose, open up.
Beth remembered why she'd called the cipher Rose to begin with, the way it fell in on itself, overlapping and secretive. It had taken her months to break up there, and they didn't have months for Rose, or even days. A knock came at the outer door hours later as Beth dozed over the decrypts. She roused with a start. Harry's voice drifted.
It's me.
What are you doing back already?
Letting him in.
Bringing you a friend.
Harry set a covered basket on the floor, raising the lid. Boots popped his square grey head over the rim.
Oh!
Beth crashed to her knees and swept up her dog. He wriggled and snuffled, trying to caper on his short legs, and her shoulders heaved. She wasn't sure how much time passed as she held her dog and told him she loved him before she could look up at Harry through swimming eyes.
You brought him for me?
Your landlady's glad to hear you're well. I swore her to secrecy, of course.
Harry picked up the basket.
Good night again, Beth.
Stay.
The word fell out of her mouth before she could think about it. He stopped, a vast shadowy shape against the door.
Or maybe you don't want to, Beth rushed on. All this week you won't really... look at me.
Harry dropped the basket, returned in one long stride and sank down to the floor beside her, reaching out slowly. His big hand warmed the side of her throat.
I didn't know if you could bear to look at me, he said quietly.
Why?
Because I left you there.
His voice was even, but his hand slid into her hair and tightened.
When your mother threw me out of her kitchen, I stumbled home and wept for you. When I should have been hunting up Commander Travis or Mab or Osler, I believed your gorgon of a mother, and you stayed there rotting.
Stop talking.
Beth linked her hands around his neck, heart drumming.
Do you want me? Do you love me? If the answer to either, I don't even need both, is yes, then please do something about it.
Harry buried his face in her collarbone, shoulders shaking. For a moment she thought he might be crying, but he was laughing.
Yes, ma'am,
he said, slipping the first button of her dress loose, then the next. She helped him with the rest, wanting to climb inside him and never come out. He rose, picked her up, tripped over boots, then walked into the little supply closet without taking his mouth away from hers. He kicked the door shut, opened it a moment later, pushed Boots out with a sorry chap, and they pitched over onto the makeshift nest of blankets.
3.5 years, Beth thought,
but it was like they'd never been apart. Harry's weight over hers, his hand catching her wrists and pinning them over her head, her toes locking around his knees as her back arched. Lying in the dark afterward, breast to breast, palm to palm, just breathing.
You've got that look.
Harry rose to let Boots in. The schnauzers stamped around their twined feet, chuffing, then curled up on the floor with an outraged expression.
What are you thinking about?
Rods and lobsters, Beth said sleepily.
I thought so.
Harry's chest vibrated with laughter as he tugged a blanket around them both.
Christ, but I love you.
Put on a scarf, Osler told Beth at dawn when the rest of the Mad Hatters returned. I can practically count the kisses, you hussy. Beth, leaning over the stack of rose, hair skewered back above her kiss-blotched neck with a pencil, barely heard a word. She'd been back at work since 3 a.m. Boots was snoring on her feet, and she was deep down the spiral. All through the day and into the winter twilight, Beth had the feeling that she'd wedged a fingernail around the edge of Wonderland's gate. Rose was fighting, but she had it firmly in her grip, spiraling down toward its calyx.
I beat the Italian naval enigma,
Beth told it. I beat the spy enigma. You're no match for me, Rose.
It wasn't a match for Harry either. Harry, who had gone to work right alongside her at 3, periodically leaning over to drop a kiss on the nape of her neck. Or the prof, or Peggy, or the Hut 6 fellow named Arthur, who'd rejoined them from Oxford when Cohen and Maurice had returned to their own offices.
We're going to pry you open tonight, Beth thought calmly.
We've got enough,
Harry said eventually, long past supper time. No one had departed for meals or sleep. They were too close, and they were almost out of time.
The bomb can make a start with this.
It has to, he didn't have to say. The hours were slipping away like grains of sand in an hourglass. Mab peered at the mess of tables and letter pairs, rods, squares and diagrams.
Can anyone make a bomb menu?
Beth looked at her blankly.
For God's sake, the way they compartmentalized our jobs is just massively unhelpful.
Too frightfully short-sighted of them, darling, Osler drawled. Not to realize our pressing need for operational understanding if a treason case ever popped up.
I did menus at BP.
Arthur was already turning Beth's work into a tidy diagram. Mab took it with a nod, and everyone gathered round. Mab's Australian husband watched with an enormous grin as his wife handled the complicated mass of plugs and wires like a snake charmer funneling vipers into baskets. Valerie Middleton was wide-eyed.
So that's how it works.
Stand clear,
Mab ordered, and threw the machine into life. The drums began to whir and rotate, their mechanical thrum filling the room and sending a bolt of excitement down Beth's spine.
Looks so primitive now, the prof said, standing beside Harry, compared to the machines I've worked on since.
The drums kept rotating and the mechanical whir kept rising. Mab's eyebrows rose along with it.
Well, get back to the other messages, she said, shooing the others. Average time to a complete job is about 3 hours with a three-wheel army key like this, and I'll be doing multiple runs. Even when and if it breaks, we've no guarantees this message has what we need.
Beth wrenched her eyes away from the hypnotic whirl, reaching for one of the other messages. She couldn't say how many hours passed, how many runs Mab did on the bomb machine as the others paced. At some point, Beth looked up to see that the machine was still, drums frozen in a silence that left her ears ringing, and that Mab was running some sort of complex check on the Enigma machine, which until now had sat neglected.
Got to test the stops, she muttered. Find the Ringstallung. The Hut 6 machine room did this part, but I wasn't there very long.
Everyone stood poised in suspense. At last, Mab looked up, swiped her dark hair out of her eyes, grinned.
Job up, strip down.
They were all cheering, voices echoing through the maintenance bay. Valerie pushed her way behind the Enigma machine, setting the wheels as Mab read off the positions. It was long past midnight, Beth realized, as she rubbed one foot along Boots's back. In fact, it might be near dawn. Harry wrapped his arms around her from behind. She could feel his heart banging away in his chest. Arthur stood polishing his spectacles. Peggy jabbed a pin into the pale knot of her hair. Osler bounced on her toes. The prof shifted from foot to foot. Mab leaned against one side of the bomb and her husband against the other, both muttering encouragement as Val laboriously hammered out the encrypted Rose message.
Give it here!
Osler snatched the ciphertext almost before it emerged from the machine. It came out in English, Beth could see at a glance, but the BP translator in Osler had snapped on duty anyway. She'd taken her place in the chain, separating the five-letter clusters into words with a few pencil strokes. Beth couldn't stay back any longer. She rushed to look over Osler's left shoulder, vaguely aware Mab had rushed to Osler's right, and everyone else crowded behind. Everyone's lips moved silently as they read the broken Rose. Beth spoke with quiet satisfaction, seeing Giles Talbot's face under his red hair.
We've got him.
Chapter 82
Giles, darling.
Osler kept her trill of greeting through the telephone perfectly natural. She was in a telephone box outside the repair lab, jammed into the box beside her. Mab gave a terse nod of approval.
Did I wake you?
Of course you did.
Giles's sleepy voice came down the line. At the sound, Beth's eyes got that unsettling feral glitter that prickled every nerve Osler had. No one was ever going to look at Beth Finch since the madhouse and think she was just a little mouse of a thing.
It's 6 in the morning.
Ursula made a shoe gesture at the Mad Hatters clustered around the telephone box. They gave her some room, and she launched into it.
Don't you dare get in a flap, Giles. I'm still furious with you for talking to the papers.
I said I was sorry.
His tone was wheedling.
You aren't giving me the old heave-ho, are you?
I should, you know.
Ursula made sure to sound pettish. But I refuse to go to the wedding today without an escort, so consider yourself forgiven. I'll swing by your flat in a few hours.
Nonsense, I'll pick you up.
You don't need to,
darling. It's the least I can do.
Ursula let it go. Pushed too hard to come to his door, he might get suspicious.
Bright and early, she said, naming the hour.
I'm your man, kitten.
That's the last time you'll ever call me kitten, you rat bastard.
Ursula rang off, looking at the Mad Hatters. Step two accomplished. Step one, of course, had been to ring MI5, regardless of the hour. But lines were busy, phones rang unanswered, or harried-sounding voices insisted on taking messages rather than listening to a word. Peggy had no luck with her GCHQ connections either. My superior's out, and I'm not bringing this to anyone but him. Ursula hadn't been surprised. No one in all of Britain, intelligence services, law enforcement, or constabulary forces combined, was going to have an ear free, not with the wedding of the century barreling down.
We go to London and sit on Giles ourselves until the wedding's over and we can present him to MI5 with our evidence, Beth stated.
Why sit on him? As long as he's not suspicious, he's not going anywhere.
What if he decides to ring the asylum a day early and finds out I'm gone? If we can't get him arrested till after the wedding, I want him locked down.
They swept the maintenance bay one last time and piled out after giving the sheeted bomb a final pat.
I wonder when they'll notice it's suddenly in much better condition, Mike remarked.
Some of the Mad Hatters were returning home now that their part was done. The prof ambling back to Cambridge, Asa to Oxford, Valerie muttering, I have no idea what I'm going to tell my husband, absolutely none. Peggy was packing the Enigma machine straight back to GCHQ, swearing she'd keep the lines ringing there until she had someone at MI5 listening. Five of them crammed into Mab's Bentley and turned toward London. Mike driving, and wasn't he scrummy, Ursula thought. He and Mab were going to have the tallest children in the world. Mab beside him with Boots, Harry squashed in the back with Beth, Ursula, and the file of decrypted Rose.
Reminds me of hitching rides to London with half-sourced RAF pilots, Ursula said, trying to extract her elbow from Harry's ear. Squished together like sardines, barreling round blind turns, absolutely pipped. Amazing we survived the war at all.
I was supposed to be hosting a royal wedding listening party today, Mab observed. I learned how to fold napkins into swans.
For some reason that struck Ursula as funny. Perhaps it was lack of sleep, or perhaps it was euphoria because today Giles Talbot was going down. Soon everyone was howling with laughter as the Bentley barreled toward the heart of London, where it hit the traffic that had come in for the wedding, and stopped dead.
20 minutes before Giles nips round,
Ursula hurled the door of her flat open, sprinting straight through to the bedroom. It had taken literally hours to crawl through the city toward Knightsbridge. They'd abandoned the Bentley and run the last six blocks. Beth now collapsed with Boots under her arm, scarlet as a telephone box, and Mab was doubled over, wheezing.
Now will you cut down on the bloody cigarettes?
Mike demanded, limping in last due to his old knee wound. Ursula had already hurled off her crumpled skirt and was shimmying into the tube of silver satin she'd set aside for the royal wedding. Giles would knock. Ursula would answer the door, looking Abby ready. She'd ask him in for a cigarette.
My nerves are all a jangle, darling.
And as soon as the door was shut, Harry and Mike would pin him. Giles Talbot was going to spend the rest of the day and night here, the Mad Hatters sitting on him until they could escort him and the Rose file to MI5. Ursula flew out, tugging on her long white gloves, pushing diamond clips into her hair.
Is it too early for a
drink? The sound of cheers and noise from the streets below made their way through the windows. Ursula slung a few ropes of pearls about her neck, took the flask Harry offered, and swigged. They were all waiting for the knock. Harry prowled back and forth like a black-maned lion. Beth ripped at her nails. Mab was on the telephone, trying to get through to someone at MI5, GCHQ, anywhere. Mike massaged his knee, remarking,
Can I pound this bugger? I get first crack,
Harry growled.
I get first crack, Beth protested. I'm the one he locked in a loony bin.
The minutes ticked by. Mab turned on the radio, and they heard the commentators.
At Kensington Palace, His Royal Highness the Duke of Edinburgh,
So that was Philip's new title, Osler thought. With the Marquis of Milford Haven, his best man, checked the time for the start of his drive.
Giles is late.
Mab and Osler exchanged glances.
He's never late. Traffic?
Osler didn't dare take that chance.
Mike, stay here. Nab him if he turns up.
Osler, Mab, Beth, and Harry headed for the door. Osler ditched the silver fox stole she'd have worn if she really were going to the wedding, yanking on J.P.E.C. Cornwall's trusty old overcoat as she ran for the stairs. Surely Giles couldn't have smelled a trap. His flat was just a few scant miles from Osler's, but the way lay right through the heart of the city, and they hadn't a hope of a taxi. People were flooding off the sidewalks and spilling into the street. Here and there an automobile inched along, horn blaring. But the crowd was a relentless river flooding inexorably toward the abbey. Harry forced a path through the crush, Beth at his elbow, Mab and Osler bringing up the rear. Overhead the sky lowered, grey and cloudy. Osler's heart thundered. Is he making a run for it? Over an hour, forcing a path through the crowds. By Buckingham Palace, people lined 50 deep along the street, holding up mirrors to get a better look. Banners flapped, pennants waved, and a great heaving cheer went through the crowd as a horse-drawn carriage emerged from the gates and began rolling toward the abbey, the Queen and Princess Margaret. Osler caught a flash of white flowers in the bridesmaid's dark hair. Then the carriage was gone. The crowd surged, and Harry shouted back to form a chain, dragging them bodily through. Off the main thoroughfare at last, into the residential streets, where people still buffeted past toward the abbey. Giles's building. A stitch stabbed Osler's side like a stiletto, but she took the stairs two at a time. How many times had she come here after a date, chatting companionably? Rot, she thought, knocking her gloved knuckles against the door, hoping her breathlessness sounded like excitement.
Giles, darling, don't faff about. What's keeping you?
No answer.
I'm breaking it down, Harry said, forcing the knob.
But the door swung open, unlocked. The room inside had been ransacked. Every drawer stood open, clothes lay on the floor, a rattle of change spilled near the door, as if money had been counted too hastily. Beth gave a wordless snarl, barely human.
I cannot have tipped him off,
Osler thought frantically, going over her telephone call. She would swear Giles had heard nothing in her voice to cause alarm. If she'd made the mistake that ended up ruining this operation...
He was coming to meet you.
Harry picked up the gloves lying atop the pristine hat by the door, a gentleman's finishing touch to a formal wedding ensemble.
It can't have been our call that spooked him. What made him?
Mab held up a newspaper lying beside a tea mug. The newspaper's front page was all wedding news, but it was folded to the back pages, a picture of Beth's unsmiling face.
Reward offered for news of the woman in this photograph. Contact the following number, as her family is concerned.
That's an MI5 number, I'll eat my hat.
Recently spotted in Buckinghamshire. Bloody hell. Do you suppose one of Dilly's neighbours saw? Who cares who spotted her? Giles knows Beth's done a bunk.
Osler's mouth had a sour taste. And he'd know if she got all the way to Bucks, she could find BP friends, people who would believe her. Beth stood silent, shaking, furious.
All right, so he's rabbited, said Mab. Wherever he goes to ground, MI5 will track him down. We stick to the plan, present our evidence, let them bring him in.
It could be tomorrow morning by the time they're putting things in motion. What if he uses the wedding confusion to train it out of London, head for the Channel? If he leaves the country...
They all looked at each other.
He can't have got far yet.
Osler touched the tea kettle on the stove.
Still warm. He'll never get a car through these crowds, so he'll be on foot, probably making for the next train out of the city.
Osler knew the trains here like the back of her hand.
Victoria Station is nearest.
That would take them into the thick of the crush again, but there was no help for it. Mab rang Osler's flat, telling Mike to meet them at Victoria as Osler hurtled down the stairs. The others pressed behind, back out to the main thoroughfare, where they were met by a wall of screams. All London was going wild. A gilt-decked coach pulled by two swiftly trotting white horses was rolling past, and Osler caught a flash of white lace in the window. Philip's royal bride.
This way!
Osler shouted, hauling her silver satin train over one arm and taking off for Victoria through the brick wall of wedding revelry. Chapter 83.
He will get away.
The words slid through Beth's blood like poison.
She didn't trust that MI5 could find him if he disappeared from London. Who knew what Moscow connections might help him vanish overseas? Perhaps the fear was irrational, but she couldn't shake the thought. If he got away now, he might get away for good. He could take the Chatham main line all the way to Dover. Mab's eyes flew over the train schedule. Disappear across the channel. There's a train leaving 20 minutes sooner than that for Brighton. He might grab the first ride out of London. Check them both. Mike and Mab charged toward the Brighton line like a couple of long-legged greyhounds. Harry went for the Chatham line, Osler shoving behind in her silver satin and diamonds, Beth bringing up the rear. Victoria Station was more of a madhouse than Clockwell during a full moon. Women in wedding day best poured off trains with flowers and pennants. Men passed flasks to toast the royal pair. Children shrieked with excitement. The crowd heaved out toward the stairs like a boat wallowing in heavy seas, Beth and her friends seemingly the only ones fighting their way in and not out. Beth couldn't breathe around the scream locked in her lungs. He won't get away. He will not get away. Osler halted, diamond roses coming loose from her hair as she craned her neck. She looked like a royal bridesmaid who had been cut out of the wedding party and run mad. Mad, mad, mad. The word chimed through Beth's mind. They fought their way through to the last platform, Harry checking every bench, Beth pushing into the gents' loo, looking for that flash of red hair. Hey there! A startled man protested, dribbling piss over his shoes. Back out, toward the station's entrance. The most recent train had emptied, passengers squeezing toward the surface. The crush thinned. Beth's eyes hunted. Nothing. Too late. The words pushed out through her stone-stiff lips. That son of a bitch, Osler snarled. The nearest ticket booth had the radio turned all the way up. Over the squeal of train wheels came the sound of the broadcast from the Abbey.
Philip, wilt thou have this woman for thy wedded wife?
We are not too late,
Osler said fiercely, a tiny diamond-decked lioness yanking Beth along. Over the pushing throng, Beth saw Mab and Mike coming toward them, no sign of a red-haired man dragging between them. The sob built in Beth's throat.
Elizabeth, Alexandra, Mary, wilt thou have this man?
Then the crowd eddied, and Beth saw him. A split-second glimpse of a man in an impeccable overcoat and trilby, fingers drumming on the handle of his overnight case as he looked down the track. And then an excited family in Sunday best pushed across the platform and hid him from view. But he was there.
Giles,
Beth whispered. And then she was making for him.
Giles,
shoving a man twice her size out of her path, knocking over a display of wedding day pennants.
Giles.
He couldn't have hurt her, but his head jerked up as though he felt her coming. Beth saw shock ripple across his face. For all his fear at seeing her escape in the paper, fear sufficient to send him running for the nearest train, he'd surely never thought she was so close. Beth Finch, the woman he'd wronged, no longer confined behind walls and straitjackets, but mere feet away, aiming at him like a sword thrust. And behind her, the others, Osler, Mab, Harry, Mike, catching sight of their enemy and closing in like hounds. Be afraid, Beth thought, feeling her hair blow across her face from the whirling gust of another train as she advanced on him. Be afraid now, traitor. Giles dropped his bag and ran. Beth sprinted after him, and Osler was only half a step behind, silver satin billowing in her wake. A party of schoolchildren cut off Mike and Harry, slowing them down, but Mab's tall shape broke forward ahead of the crush. Beth saw the cry that escaped Giles the moment he registered Mab's unmistakable Valkyrie head. He broke left, Mab made a grab for his elbow and tweaked his gabardine sleeve, but he stumbled and kept moving, sliding through the clumps of passengers disgorging from the newest train. He was making for the stairs leading above ground. Mab and Osler and Beth were all running together now, Harry and Mike somewhere behind, but the crowd was too thick and they'd all sprinted themselves breathless getting to the station. Mab's breath was coming in cigarette rasps. Osler, with her shorter stride, was falling back. Beth tried to put on a burst of speed, but her lungs were still weak from asylum pneumonia. And Giles was pulling ahead with a bound onto the first stairs. If he lost himself in the vast crowds outside... Beth saw Osler swing toward a man leaning against the station wall, reading a heavy leather-bound book. Osler wrenched it out of his hands and hurled it like she was bowling a ball in a Bletchley Park Rounders game. The book hit Giles square on the shoulder, and he stumbled on the steps. That was all Mab needed, catching up in three leaping strides of her endless legs, seizing him by the elbow, and swinging him back round into the station with a snarl that bared every tooth in her head. Giles ripped his arm free with a shout, but momentum sent him stumbling headlong toward Beth. Everything seemed to slow in that instant, enough for her to gather her limbs and launch herself into his chest. Beth bore him to the ground with a scream of fury that scraped her throat like a handful of knives and spun every head within 50 yards. In the sudden, stunned hush, Beth heard tinny voices from the ticket booth radio, the Westminster Abbey choir, voices lifted in joyous clarion song. The royal couple were married. Underneath her, Beth could feel Giles shuddering. She looked into his face inches under her own, and a wave of disgust and fury lashed her as she realized he was crying. "I'm sorry," he whispered. "I don't want your sorry," Beth spat, lungs still fighting for air. "You cut price, second rate, asinine little traitor." "I'm not." "That's exactly what you are." Osler limped up, panting, one shoe missing, and sat down in a billow of silver satin on Giles's tangled legs. "Don't even think about getting up. And by the way," twisting off her emerald, "the engagement's off. Never liked green stones anyway. Shall I spike him?" Mab placed one smart-heeled boot on Giles's forehead, glaring down. He lay without struggling, tears slipping down his cheeks in tired gusts. Whispers were rising from the puzzled onlookers.
"Here now, what's going on?"
A policeman, red-faced, indignant, the most welcome sight on earth.
"Brawling on Her Highness's wedding day now. I won't stand for that, not in Victoria Station."
Mab tried to explain. Harry's voice sounded, and then people were shoving, voices rising. A railway conductor tried to haul Mab away from where she was still half-standing on Giles, and Mike promptly clocked him. The man went down like a sack of turnips. Osler was gesticulating at the policeman, who shouted her down, and Beth was the only one to hear Giles's terrified whisper, "What's going to happen to me?" Beth looked down into his eyes, the man who'd stolen years of her life. Betrayer of her friends, betrayer of the future queen, who was even now signing her bridal registry. Betrayer of the stalwart stammering king, who had walked her down the aisle. Betrayer of Churchill, who beamed beside the new prime minister in the abbey. Churchill, who had limped into Bletchley Park and told them the war couldn't be won without them. Betrayer of Bletchley Park, all that it was, all that Beth loved. She pushed herself unsteadily away from Giles, not wanting to touch him. "Whatever happens to you," she rasped, "it won't be enough."
"You are all under arrest," the policeman trumpeted.
And the world went right on sliding into madness. Chapter 84. "I missed the wedding of the century," Osler thought, contemplating her cell bars. "Oh well." The police had ended up arresting Giles, Osler, Mab, Beth, Harry, Mike, the man with the leather-bound book, and two ticket collectors. Now here they all were in a drunk tank who knew where, with threats from the policemen that they could all bloody well stay there overnight or until the wedding celebrations were over, whichever came first. Somewhere further along the corridor, Osler had seen Mab and Mike go into one cell, Beth and Harry and Giles into another. Giles was protesting, but not very clearly. Somehow in the scuffle, before handcuffs came out, he'd tripped over Harry's boot, crashed to the ground, and come up with a dislocated jaw. Sad, that. Osler smiled, contemplating the wreck of her silver satin Dior, hearing the rattle of bars. "We did it," she thought. Well, almost. Giles Talbot couldn't talk his way out of this cell before Peggy Rock got through to someone at her GCHQ offices and rallied assistance, or, failing that, before Osler played her trump card. "If it's not too inconvenient, sir," she'd already drawled to the sergeant, sliding a discreet pound note into his palm. "Could I just bip out to the desk and make the teensiest phone call before you release anyone in our party?" Blinking her lashes, playing up the Mayfair vowels, clearly a female with the kind of family you didn't want descending wrathfully on your doorstep to rescue their lost princess.
"Witless bloody dibs," the sergeant had muttered.
But Osler just grinned. The phrase had lost its sting. Could a witless deb have helped catch a traitor to the crown? No. and the important people, her BP family, the consort of their future queen, and a highly secret portion of MI5, knew, or would soon know, what she'd done. If the rest of the world continued to rate her low, well, that was their loss. Ozla Kendall had proved herself to everyone who mattered.
"You're definitely not my wife," a voice commented from the other side of the cell bars.
Ozla looked up to see a tall officer in rifle brigade uniform. "I don't think I'm your wife either," Ozla replied, "unless I'm suffering from spectacular amnesia." The officer turned to the sergeant.
"Why exactly did I get called to the clink for some woman I'm not married to?"
His voice sounded familiar. The sergeant handed Osler's overcoat over.
"Your name was in the label, Major Cornwall. That desk clerk should have verified."
Commotion farther along the corridor made the sergeant break off.
"A moment, I'll be back."
He hurried off, and Ozla looked at the worn-out overcoat she'd been hauling about since the Café de Paris. Looked at the man holding it. Dark-haired, a major's insignia on his uniform. A military cross. "You're J.P.E.C. Cornwall." Her good Samaritan with the low voice, so soothing in the aftermath of the explosion.
"Sit down, Ozma, and let me see if you're hurt."
Ozla scrambled up, coming to the bars. "What do all those initials stand for? I've been wanting to know for years."
"John Percival Edwin Charles Cornwall," he said,
still looking bemused, throwing a half salute.
"Major, Rifle Brigade, first in Egypt, then with the partisans in Czechoslovakia."
Ozla reached through the grill, took hold of her Good Samaritan's collar, drew his head down, and kissed him warmly on the mouth through the bars of her cell. She smelled heather and smoke, that wonderful scent that had long since faded out of his overcoat. "I've owed you that since you pulled me out of the rubble of the Café de Paris," she said, drawing back with a grin. "For God's sake, tell me, who's Ozma of Oz?"
"L. Frank Baum's Lost Princess. My favourite book."
He gave her a slow, thoughtful look.
"Pleased to meet you, Ozla Kendall. May I say, you have very nice handwriting."
"Oh, blast. You actually got my message in a bottle of letters." Ozla had assumed those missives had dropped into limbo, considering the lack of response. She'd never written anything about BP, but still.
"They sat in a heap with my old landlady until I finally came back to London. I wrote you back then, but that Buckinghamshire address was defunct."
He regarded her with a nearly invisible smile.
"Did you ever get over that chap who broke your heart?"
Ozla waved a hand. "He's last year's news, darling."
"Good. You sounded very low for a while there."
"I'm really quite a fizzing sort normally. You're just always running into me when I'm in a blue funk. Heartbroken, or recently bombed, or incarcerated."
"Yes. Why are you in jail, exactly?"
"Afraid I can't say. Official Secrets Act." Major John Cornwall rubbed a hand through his dark hair, looking bemused again. But the sergeant's voice interrupted.
"You're free to go, sir. Sorry for the inconvenience. And you, Miss Kendall, have been cleared to make your telephone call."
"Don't go anywhere," Ozla told J.P.E.C. Cornwall with a sparkling smile, breezing past him for the front desk, where her trump card hit the table as she rang a number by heart. "A message for Prince Philip, please. Yes, the Duke of Edinburgh. I'm aware he's at his wedding breakfast." She lowered her voice and murmured for a long moment, as every policeman within earshot gaped. "No, I can't give further details, but he gave me this number for any moment of dire need, and that need is now."
Chapter 85. Secret. Intended recipient eyes only. As per penalty of prosecution under Official Secrets Acts 1911 and 1920. 21 December, 1947. "Our red-haired chap has been very talkative. After we've finished picking his brain, I recommend our Killoran Bay facility in Scotland, significantly more secure, if more bleak, than the sanitarium which failed to hold Miss Finch. One final thought. There are hints that our red-haired chap is not the only compromised individual in our circles. Once the current matter is finished, I suggest we divert our efforts toward this new information. Time to settle accounts."
"It looks dead," Mab said. "Deader than Manderley after the fire," Ozla agreed.
Beth gazed across the weed-choked lake at Bletchley Park's mansion. The green copper dome and elaborate brickwork thrust against the grey winter sky, and a few people came in and out. But BP had changed. The long block buildings and old green huts were shuttered for Christmas, the grounds all but empty. But it was more than that. Beth shivered in her smart new tartan coat and scarlet scarf, bending down to rub Boots's head. She was suddenly glad she hadn't come alone. "It's not usually this empty. The space is rented out now, for training courses and so forth." Osler's breath puffed in the cold. In her full-skirted ivory coat, edged in silvery mink, complete with mink hood sitting on her dark hair, she looked like a Christmas tree fairy. "If it weren't 2 days before Christmas, this place would be bustling."
"Not with our kind of bustle."
Mab looked at the mansion. "Remember the day we arrived, and you called it lavatory gothic?" Beth still couldn't say a word. The mansion's double doors, which she'd pushed open in the dead of a rainy night with Matapan's decrypted battle plans in her fist, the lakeshore where the Mad Hatters had discussed so many books, the cottage, out of sight from here, whitewashed and homely. Mentally, she opened the door to see Dilly Knox at his desk.
"Have you got a pencil? We're breaking codes."
Tears blurred her eyes. "Let's go."
Neither Oslin nor Mab argued. They turned, meandering back toward the gates, which were no longer manned by stern guards. A faint sprinkling of snow frosted the ground.
"So, we're all done with our debriefings."
Mab stalked along in forest green trousers and a long jade green coat, a fedora like a man slanted across her brow.
"MI5 isn't going to call us in again, surely?"
"Doubtful, darling," Osler said. "Did either of you find out just why the Russians were discussing Giles via Enigma traffic in the first place? I asked during my interview, but the chap got dreadfully snippy."
"Peggy told me after her debriefing," Beth said. "My guess was right. The Reds captured a German Enigma machine during one of those back and forths across Soviet territory. They passed a few messages through Giles's contact in London, trying it out. Giles was hoping they'd adopt it for their own coded traffic. Our Y stations were monitoring Soviet radio chatter, so it was flagged and Dilly saw it."
"What do you think happened to Giles?"
Mab stared at the lake, and Beth knew she was remembering when she and Osler first clapped eyes on him, wading out in his drawers, grinning and friendly.
"I don't think we're ever going to know," Beth said, indifferent.
"What's more, I don't give a toss," Osler pronounced, "as long as he's gone."
They wandered clear of BP, not looking back.
"Are we all going to the station?" Osler asked at last. "I'm nipping back to London. Mab's off to York. Don't tell me you're going to the village to see your family, Beth."
"No."
The Finch family was in an uproar. First Beth's escape from Clockwell, then her official release, then the news that her father had left Mrs. Finch out of the blue. He'd moved to a tiny flat and was refusing to come home. The house would apparently have to be sold. Mother had taken shrieking to her bed. None of Beth's siblings wanted her to live with them. Beth had already decided the entire matter could be worked out without her.
"I'm waiting here. Harry's driving over from Cambridge."
Osler cocked her head.
"You and Harry? Is that still on? Don't you want something more, I don't know, usual?"
"Marriage," Beth supposed she meant. "Children, a house, a man's shoes to line up with hers." Beth shook her head but smiled.
"It's what I want, and it's very much still on."
"Well, where are you going to live? You can bunk with me in Knightsbridge as long as you like, you know."
Bless Osler, Beth thought, but no. 3.5 years in the asylum, what she craved now was space to herself. Space to process what had happened to her, let the bad dreams come, get through it and out the other side. Harry understood that without a word needing to be said. He'd wrangled her a clerk's job at Scopelli's music shop in Cambridge, and a room too.
"Mr. Scopelli says you can use the old bomb shelter bedroom in the back, until you get digs of your own."
Beth imagined mornings alone with Boots and a cup of tea, listening to Bach partitas, afternoons quietly working the counter, Sunday mornings in chapel, thinking of codes as hymns soared. Harry bringing lunch from his college every day, staying the night when his family could spare him. She smiled again. For now, that sounded fine.
"I still think MI5 owes you compensation," Mab said tartly.
locked up unfairly and still managing to bring a traitor to their door. A little cash to rent you a flat is the least they could do. There might be something, eventually.
Beth knew she wasn't going to work at the music shop forever. If you want the sort of job that uses our skills, come to GCHQ with me, Peggy had said after their final debrief. Even without a war, Britain needs people like us. They'd leap for joy to get you.
Yes, Beth thought. Her work was a drug she had no desire to ever purge from her blood. She wanted to go back to it, just not quite yet. She was no longer trapped inside the clock, but she didn't feel like she'd entirely caught up with time outside it either.
To tide you over until those chintzy MI5 snakes cough up.
Osler took out her cigarette case and extracted a flash of green from among the Gauloise. Here, pawn it.
Beth looked at the ring with its emerald the size of a halfpenny.
You're sure?
I thought about throwing it in Giles's face when we were arrested, Osler mused. But really, why should he get it back? And outside novels, who really tosses emerald rings around like seashells anyway? I'd far rather it went to rent you a flat.
Or maybe, Beth thought, it could pay for treatment for her go-playing friend still locked in Clockwell, to see if anything might be done for her.
Thank you, Oz.
Give me one of those cigarettes, Mab asked before Osler put away the case. And a light. Oh, what's that?
Examining Osler's silver lighter.
J.P.E.C.C. The Honourable John Percival Edwin Charles Cornwall, Osler said, lighting two Gauloises.
How the hell do you walk into jail with a traitor and walk out again with a lord?
He's not a lord yet. His father's the 7th Baron Cornwall, that's all. They have an absolutely topping place in Hampshire. I'm visiting over New Year's, once I've negotiated my new post with my Tatler editor.
Osler passed Mab's cigarette over.
Christmas in York for you, my queen.
I'll be back in time to bundle Lucy and Eddie up for their first snowball fight. You wouldn't believe how excited Mike gets about snow. It's an Australian thing.
Mab turned her wedding ring around her finger.
It'll be good to be home.
Funny thing about homes.
Osler looked thoughtful, taking a deep draw off her cigarette.
I was always thinking I didn't have one, not really. Houses, hotels, places to stay, but no home, no real family, not really belonging anywhere.
She looked back at Bletchley Park.
But there's this place.
This place is dead, Beth pointed out.
We still belong here, all of us. Look how everyone answered the call, even people we barely knew, like Asa and the Prof, Cohen and Harry's cousin Maurice, all hurrying out to Corn's Wood without a question asked. That's a kind of family.
Osler smiled, a few snowflakes catching in her dark lashes.
Not exactly the sort of family I was always dreaming about, but it still counts.
They stood in the softly falling snow, putting off the moment of departure. Osler returning to London, Beth thought, me to Cambridge, Mab all the way back to York. Despite Osler's talk of family, what were the chances they'd ever meet up again without the work of Bletchley Park to draw them together? The three of them had nothing in common besides BP. In the normal course of life, they would never have crossed paths at all.
Thank you, Beth blurted. Both of you, breaking me out of the asylum, hiding me.
It had to be said. They had to be thanked. What if she never got the chance after today?
I don't need thanks.
Mab took a last drag on her cigarette.
Duty, honour, oaths.
They're not just for soldiers, not just for men.
I want to thank you anyway.
Beth took a deep breath, eyes blurring.
And I'm sorry. Coventry, not warning you.
She couldn't hold her eyes. She looked away, back toward Bletchley Park.
Bloody hell, Beth.
Mab dropped her cigarette, grinding it out under one high-heeled boot.
There are things I don't want to forgive you for, you or Oz, and maybe I won't ever be able to completely. But that doesn't mean we don't...
She stopped, looked up, brows slanted at their most ferocious angle. The rushed three-way hug was fierce, spiky, awkward. Beth felt the silkiness of Osler's mink against her cheek, inhaled Mab's familiar perfume.
Look.
Mab scowled as they pulled apart.
Trains run all the way to York. Don't be strangers, you two.
We could pick a book, start up the Mad Hatters again.
Osler swiped at her eyes.
Meet at Bessie's. Have a tea party with actual scones and jam.
Beth pushed her wave of hair behind one ear.
I've been reading the Principia Mathematica.
She found Isaac Newton flat going, but sometimes she caught a glimpse of intriguing spirals round the edges of the complicated exercises Harry showed her. Spirals of numbers rather than letters.
Oh, darling, don't make us do maths, Ozla groaned. What about the Road to Oz? I've been devouring bomb.
Too fantastical, Mab complained. There's a new Hercule Poirot coming out.
We never did agree about books,
Ozla said. We never agreed about anything, Mab snorted, and checked her watch.
I'm going to miss my train.
A final nod, and then Beth stood before the gates with boots waffling about the frozen ground, watching the ivory coat and the jade-green coat swing up the road.
Ozla! She called suddenly, almost shouting. Mab!
They turned in unison, those two smart brunettes who had stalked with such style into the Finch kitchen and Beth's life in 1940. Beth filled her lungs.
These have knelled your fall and ruin,
Ozla caught on first.
But your ears were far away.
Mab picked it up.
English lassies rustling papers.
They finished in a triumphant shout.
Through the sodden Bletchley day.
And for the last time in decades, Bletchley Park resounded with the laughter of codebreakers. Epilogue. Duchess of Cambridge reopens Bletchley Park. June 2014.
Jobs up, strip down.
The replicated bomb machine stops, and the Duchess of Cambridge smiles at its demonstrator during her tour of Bletchley Park, Britain's now famous code-breaking centre. During the Second World War, this stately home thrummed with top-secret activity as thousands of men and women worked to crack the unbreakable Axis military codes, a feat that, according to many historians, shortened the war by at least 2 years. The former Kate Middleton, stunning in military-style navy and white skirt and blouse by Alexander McQueen, officially reopens Bletchley Park after a year-long restoration project that has restored the mansion and its surrounding huts to their wartime appearance. The site deteriorated into near dereliction after the war, but now hosts hundreds of thousands of visitors every year. The Duchess has a personal reason for visiting BP. Her grandmother Valerie Middleton, née Glasborough, was employed in Hut 16. Retracing her grandmother's footsteps, the Duchess met with veteran codebreakers such as Mrs. Mab Sharp, who works part-time at BP as a bomb machine demonstrator. Mrs. Sharp, a grey-haired, unbent 5'11" at age 96, instructed her old colleague's granddaughter in the art of intercepting and decoding a Morse code message. "What an incredible story," the Duchess said. "I was aware of it when I was a young girl, and often asked Granny about it, but she was very quiet and never said anything." "We didn't talk in those days, ma'am. We still don't." Asked if women like herself were ever called to put their talents to use after the war, Mrs. Sharp gave a noncommittal smile. "Oh no, it's enough to see the work appreciated today." It's not a view shared by all Bletchley Park veterans, even now that the term of secrecy has officially expired. Mrs. Sharp, surrounded by six-foot children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren, appears happy to reminisce with Bletchley Park visitors. Other veterans have refused to release their stories until after their deaths. View the spate of posthumous memoirs, such as Bletchley Blethering's by Lady Cornwall, née Ozla Kendall, the award-winning satirist and Tatler columnist, whose droll, touching account of her time as a Hutford translator was not published until after her death in 1974. And other veterans consider the oath of secrecy binding in perpetuity. Miss Beth Finch, retired GCHQ, is known to have served as one of Bletchley Park's few female cryptanalysts, but the white-haired 98-year-old in her rose-pink cardigan politely refuses to discuss her war work. "That would be a violation of my oath." The code of secrecy upheld by Bletchley Park's workers is fully as remarkable as their code-breaking achievements. In an age of instantaneous social media, jaws drop at the idea that thousands of men and women were simply handed the most incendiary secret of the war and kept it, to a man or a woman. Churchill famously referred to them as the geese who laid the golden eggs, but never cackled.
Despite the bustle of Bletchley Park today, the camera flashes of the royal visit, the millions of visitors come to marvel at the bomb machines. Something of that golden silence still holds over these grounds in a hush of honored and unspoken secrets. There are stories here still untold, without a doubt. Stories locked in steel trap codebreaker minds, behind steel trap codebreaker lips. Bletchley Park's walls have been renovated. If only they could speak. But some codes will never be broken. This is Saskia Malleveld. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Rose Code, a novel, by Kate Quinn. Presented by William Morrow and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Jennifer Lopes. Text copyright, 2021, by Kate Quinn. Production copyright, 2021, by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.